welcome to Making and Breaking Social Policy, a podcast about how we collectively respond to big social issues and what this means for social and community practice. My name is Ben Lohmeyer, and I'm a lecturer and researcher in social work at Flinders University. Today's special guests are Professor Sarah Wendt and Senior Lecturer Kate Seymour from the social work team here at Flinders Uni, and we're going to have a conversation about their research on domestic violence and domestic violence workforce in Australia. Professor Sarah Wendt is a Matthew Flinders Fellow and Professor in Social Work and Director of the Social Work Innovation Research Living Space, or SWRLS, at the Research Centre here at Flinders Uni. She has taught in social work for over a decade. Prior to academia, Sarah practiced in the field of domestic violence. She has published on violence against women and social work practice. Current research projects explore the impact of domestic violence on women's citizenship, service provision for Aboriginal communities experiencing family violence, and engaging men to address domestic violence. In particular, Sarah has been researching rural women's experiences of domestic violence for over a decade in Australia, and more recently, how domestic violence work shapes practitioners living and working in rural communities. Dr. Kate Seymour is a senior lecturer in social work at Flinders University in South Australia and is a founding member of the SWRLS, Social Work Research Innovation Living Space. Her research focuses on gender, masculinities, and violence and spans the field of social work and criminology. Kate is especially interested in the framing of violence in the policy prevention and practice realms and the ways in which this reflects and reinforces social hierarchies and structural inequalities. Kate is a qualitative researcher with a background in direct social work practice and management, including in the areas of adult offending and work with male perpetrators of domestic and family violence. So in this episode, we'll be talking in particular about the National Plan to Reduce Violence Against Women and Their Children. According to the National Plan, one in three Australian women have experienced physical violence since the age of 15. Almost one in five has experienced sexual violence. It is time for that to change. The National Plan to Reduce Violence Against Women and Their Children 2010 to 2022, or often referred to, especially in this plan, conversation as the plan or the National Plan, brings together the efforts of government across the nation to make a real and sustained reduction in the levels of violence against women. End quote. So that's a quote from the National Plan. There are six national outcomes that the plan aims to achieve in 12 years. Number one, as communities are safe and free from violence. Number two, relationships are respectful. Number three, Indigenous communities are strengthened. Number four, services meet the needs of women and their children experiencing violence. Number five, justice responses are effective. And number six, perpetrators stop their violence and are held to account. If you want to know more about the plan or about the work of Sarah and Kate, you will find links to all of that in the show notes. Recognise that Flinders Social Work operates on the traditional lands and water of the Kaurna people, and we pay respects to elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge their sovereignty and continued responsibility to care for country. So Sarah and Kate, thank you so much for joining me today for this conversation. You both recently published several papers, together and with some other colleagues as well, about domestic and family violence and the domestic violence workforce, including, and I'm just going to read out the names of the papers because I think the name's actually really useful to help us anchor the conversation a little bit. So we've got Strengthening the Domestic and Family Violence Workforce, Key Questions. We've got Building Collaboration with Child Protection and Domestic and Family Violence Sectors, Trialling a Living Lab Approach. Women's Perceptions of Safety After Domestic Violence, Exploring Experiences of a Safety Contact Program. And then the other one I was really interested in as well was Workplace Violence Against Domestic and Family Violence and Sexual Assault Workers, a gendered setting-based approach. So they're all separate papers, and I'll include links to those in the show notes, so that's great, so people can grab those. But for today's conversation, I'm really interested in the ways that your work in these papers intersects with the National Plan to Reduce Violence Against Women and Children, so 2010 to 2022. So I'm hoping we can chat about some of the implications of your work, this kind of large and wide-reaching social policy that is the National Plan. So there's kind of lots of parts to it. It's ambitious, but probably has problems in other places. And all those bits and pieces, you know, it'd be great to chat through some of those. Also hoping that you might be able to help us make sense of some of the history and discourses that continue to dominate social policy in this place, as well as practice. So, you know, I've just got a small amount I want to chat about today. Thank you so much for coming and having the chat.
Sarah, we might start with you. Can you start with telling us a little bit about key ideas or principles that underpin your work on domestic and family violence? For example, in one of the titles, it mentions a living lab. What's that?
Excellent. So good question, Ben. I think, you know, like as researchers or social workers commenting on policy and practice, it is kind of important to understand our own ideas or the key ideas and principles that we bring to our work, because they ultimately then influence how we see things or how we then practice or recommend. And so for myself and for my colleague, Kate, before I kind of explain the living lab approach, when I get asked, you know, what are the key ideas or principles that underpin, you know, our work on domestic and family violence, I have to say gender and power. So they're front and centre in how we understand the social problem of domestic and family violence. And so when you take that stance, those concepts of gender and power then influence how I see policy should be formed and what policy should concentrate on, as well as then, you know, how practice then is played out in the everyday. So for me, gender and power relations have to be central in any kind of discussions of domestic and family violence. In terms of, you know, then how do we look at this from a social work perspective? So how are we trying to shape policy, or how are we trying to do research in this area? The living lab approach is, I was going to say it's old, but it's new. So the living lab approach kind of has these ideals of appreciative inquiry, participatory action research, giving things a go, it's okay to fail, working in partnership with. And these ideas have, the living lab has kind of come out of, believe it or not, like IT and kind of other disciplines. But when you look at these principles, it's really closely related, I think, to how social work's been working for some time. And so we in this space as researchers trying to influence policy or practice have made a commitment that when we talk about change or talk about the issues, that we involve practitioners, that we involve policymakers, and that we involve those with the lived experience of these issues like domestic and family violence. So the living lab is an approach that brings all these key stakeholders together to actually have the conversation about what is the problem perceived to be, therefore what is the solution, so what works for whom. And so the living lab approach kind of pushes us as social workers, or gives us the infrastructure to bring everyone to the table to have a conversation about policy and practice that's research informed, so the three don't sit in silos, the three have to try and kind of come together.
Yeah, wow, that's great. Thank you. One of the things I like to think about when I'm listening to people talk about their research is how it connects to some of the key themes in the topic that we're teaching, which this podcast is for, or this podcast is kind of labelled after as well. But you named the idea of how a problem is represented to be, and how key stakeholders bringing in those different voices will help us understand that from different perspectives. That's fantastic. Wow, so you're Living Lab embodies that almost policy analysis approach. That's really cool. Thank you. Great. Okay. So that's what a Living Lab is and some of the principles. Can you tell us a little bit more about how, well, so going back a step, this podcast is about how social policy makes and breaks human services practice. And so that's one of the things we want to think about for some of your work. How does your work offer us ways to think through critical questions and issues in the domestic family violence workforce? So can you tell us what are some of the key questions that your research asks, and how might that help us think about how policy is making and breaking that workforce?
I guess I would actually challenge the question, well, not the question, but the framing of social policy as making or breaking practice, because I think that and part of what we certainly come up against in the Living Lab approach is that actually it's not all top down, that policy doesn't drive practice, although it does in a big sense, but also that policy is lived out and enacted in practice. So actually social workers or practitioners in the area, whatever they are, actually create policy themselves in terms of policy in action. So I think, you know, it's really important not to get too caught up in, you know, oh, it's the policy that matters and they make the policy and we just, you know, implement it, because we know it's not that simple. Actually, we have a lot of discretion and we do a lot that makes policy real in people's lives, and that's where we need to pay really careful attention. And I think that's part of what the Living Lab seeks to do in terms of meeting and working with practitioners, you know, at various levels in various industry locations, is try to get a sense of what sense people make of the work, of the kind of what the work is, what the intention is, and how to do it. So it's trying to kind of not just look at it as this is the policy and this is the practice, but to look at how they intermesh and mould and shape each other.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah. That's really important. It's so easy to overlook that other half of that idea of making or breaking, is that you actually practice, and the way we do it makes or breaks the policy as well.
Well, and it makes policy real, because policy in terms of people's lives is only what they, you know, what they're faced with when they go to an agency or whatever. So, you know, no matter what the policy is, if when they go to an agency and work with practitioners, those practitioners become the face and the reality of a policy. So let's not underestimate that we actually have enormous power as practitioners, whatever sort of practitioners we are.
I was going to say, I really respect those comments, Kate, but I was also a bit intrigued by the construct of make or break, actually, Ben. Like, so I was kind of like thinking, you know, how could you interpret that? And it kind of takes me back to that kind of question of what is the problem we're trying to solve, like through policy or practice, because for me, an issue like domestic and family violence, that problem is highly contested, and there are multiple ideas that construct that problem. So if you went down a particular road that was, say, a school of thought or a discipline that doesn't pay attention to gender, for example, that could take you down a different policy imperative that would produce particular practice.
Yeah.
So it influences, you know, kind of that continuum of intervention in the human services, the construction of the problem.
And so, that's also how the policy may say one thing, but the practice can absolutely, you know, take that in a whole lot of different ways.
Yes.
Because of people's own sense of what the issue is or what the problem is or how it should be solved. So in my own work, I kind of came into this, but one of the points of interest was when I did qualitative interviews with practitioners who work with men who use violence against women and children. And what struck me from that was what they were telling me about how they thought of their work, what they saw the problem as, and therefore, you know, what they saw as the solution, is that there was so much richness and depth at that level that didn't necessarily reflect policy in a simplistic way. It wasn't contrary necessarily, but it was in other ways. So, and it wasn't because those workers were doing a bad job or whatever. Mm. It was because broader discourses actually come through in the way that we as workers do our work, regardless of policy. So policy is important, but it's also the way that we carry broader discourse, dominant discourses, and carry them out in people's lives that actually can make a really important impact. And in that research, that's what we saw very clearly, was that the actual work with men was very much shaped by some of those dominant discourses around, you know, what's the problem, what isn't the problem, and who's responsible, et cetera, et cetera.
Correct.
So I think what we're both saying is that the policy practice, they're not separate, they're very intermeshed.
Definitely, yeah. Mm. I think that's a really important message, particularly for, say, new practitioners, or even thinking about our students again, who come into this topic. And I had a tutorial with them just this morning, and one of the fun things I like to do is, as we're waiting for people to come into our online tutorials, because that's what we have at the moment, we're just coming out of lockdown, is to put up a little poll for the students to say, okay, you know, tell us about yourselves a little bit while we're waiting for everyone to join in. I put up a poll and said, what was your first reaction to coming into this policy topic? Were you excited, etc.? And most people just said they thought this was going to be a really scary topic, really, really hard. They perhaps didn't see the relevance of it, and you know they didn't see themselves as a political person. Mm. But the reality is that we know that policy and practice are really closely tied together, and it's not really enough for us just to focus on practice or just to focus on policy. We have to see them together.
Mm.
So thank you. That's really useful. Mm. I'm wondering if we can draw this idea down a little bit further and think about, Sarah, you mentioned gender as an important part of the way that you approach this topic. What maybe some of the dominant discourses around gender are that exist in policy, and then how that may be similar or different to what we see in practice. You were saying in practice they had nuanced ideas of what gender meant, but whether they're similar or different to the ones that exist in the policy. What do you think?
You know, we're talking about the national plan in terms of policy right now.
When I think about the national plan, you know, and when you think about like history or, you know, how a problem becomes known, and in this space of domestic and family violence, this sector has had a long history, and I don't think people realise the history of it in terms of, you know, the social problem of domestic and family violence wasn't named until, say, the last, was it 30 years or something? So, and that was mainly named by a grassroots movement of women victims. So then you have a service sector that's kind of grown from that, and in parallel you have a service sector growing then to respond, you know, to people who use violence. So this history of domestic and family violence hasn't been neat. It hasn't been linear. It's actually been contested and it's been political. And so when you go to something like the National Plan, sometimes I think, you know, as researchers or, you know, as social workers, we are taught to critique, which is a very good thing in and of itself. But I can remember feeling a sense of relief that we actually had for the first time a national plan to state this as a social problem in Australia. And when you look at the national plan, it actually does name, you know, maybe more implicitly, but it does name women as victims and men as perpetrators. And so in this political context, I have to say I had some sense of relief or, you know, a little bit of a yay win moment that we do have a national plan to address violence against women and their children. You can then go and look at that plan and its different iterations, and you can really engage in it in lots of complex ways, and we can pull it apart. But if I'm going to be simplistic, I did have some sense of relief that gender was recognised in some form. But it's also, but if you wanted to keep going down that rabbit hole, gender is not just binary either, and it's not just men and women. Like as such, we have lots of complex, you know, intersectional interplays in domestic and family violence. But I suppose, you know, when you're in this kind of contested space, wins, you'll take them wherever you kind of can sometimes. I don't know what you think about that, Kate.
I think that the National Plan has a number of faces, and in terms of a kind of a milestone or a landmark, I think it's pretty well recognised that that was significant as a national statement. It also, unfortunately, and I think this is somewhat to do with the kind of the positioning of gender and the way that domestic violence tends to be viewed through a gendered lens, which is totally appropriate, but often only a gendered lens, and how that plays out. So, for example, in the National Plan, there is a, you know, some ambiguity around whether they name men and women.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they, for example, the definition of domestic violence that the whole plan is based upon talks about people, not men or women. So, you know, it's kind of hedges its bets a bit there, but it is implicit, I think. However, it doesn't, the way it talks about violence only sees some people as, it positions some sections or some groups as violent and some sectional groups as the victimised, and it leaves out a whole lot of others. So it's quite kind of blunt in the way it does that. It also positions and talks about violence as being something that particular groups do, and it very much is focused on First Nations people in a particular way, on particular groups as being those that we need to worry about. And so some of those things are fundamentally problematic, and it also overlooks entirely violence. You know, it sees gender, the gendered power, as essentially men are powerful, women aren't, and so therefore it overlooks entirely anything around, say, violence within same-sex relationships, because it's not able to grapple with those more complex understandings of what gendered power means, that gender isn't necessarily just about male or female, that it's actually much more complex. So I think in terms of how it interacts and understands issues of power beyond gender, it's very limited. And whilst that doesn't make it any less significant as a landmark document, it's very problematic in terms of kind of Australia today.
That's amazing. Thank you. I mean, two really important points that I can see clearly have implications for workforce as well. So we have a clear point when this issue is recognised and therefore you can have a response to it officially, right? And so that creates a certain type of practice and workforce. And then how we frame up the issue around gender in terms of only gender as well creates a certain kind of response to that as well. So that's really useful. Can you tell us any more about what you know about the implications for that in the workforce? And what does that result in terms of what we get in a domestic violence workforce?
Yeah, so this is the question that probably Kate and I and colleagues are really engaging with and grappling with today. So when you kind of have a look at the national plan and its iterations, it actually speaks, you know, to all the themes that you would want it to speak to, you know, like about communities being safe and free, you know, relationships being respectful, you know, justice responses, perpetrators being stopped. So you can see, you know, the big themes that need to sit in a plan. But when you kind of, so we've had a discussion with you, Ben, about, you know, the history of domestic and family violence, how that then moves into policy, then how that shapes into practice. But when you have a look at the national plan, only in its last kind of fourth iteration and maybe its third, did it hint at a workforce. So Kate and I and colleagues, we kind of stood back and thought, so this national plan sets up a really highly complex social problem, which has been researched at length. It's naming all these expectations now about how and assumptions about how to solve it, but it is silent on who's going to do this work.
Right.
And so so Kate and I, we wanted to have a look at, you know, what are the assumptions about this workforce? Who are they? Therefore, if you construct a problem in a particular way or you set policy and practice around it, what knowledge are you assuming then? So then what knowledge or skills, you know, then need to be brought to the table? And knowledge and skills don't get formed in a vacuum either. They're constructed and they're formed by contested ideas. We've become intrigued with this question around, you know, when a national plan is set up like that, or you have government naming this as an epidemic and, you know, a national emergency, what is the infrastructure then behind that to actually respond to it? And when you start digging deep, there's a lot of assumptions and holes in who we think that workforce is.
And not much has changed.
So that's why when we go back to the history,
yeah,
if you think about the history, this. And so Kate, you know, I've loved working with Kate because in a sense, when you go back to the history of this workforce, you're reminded that it was a volunteer movement, largely by women. This sector has now evolved where 80% of the workforce is women trying to work in the area of domestic and family violence, largely part-time or casual on insecure work. And so now, you know, I might handball this to Kate, but we're thinking about when you've got such a big gendered issue, you can't ignore a gender analysis of the workforce being asked to respond to it either. So there is gender and power in our assumptions about who has to solve this problem and who's responsible for solving it. And in comparison or differently, the men's sector in terms of responding to men has been very different to that picture I've just painted in terms of responding to women, where it's been largely criminal response or, you know, ad hoc bits of training around how to work with men through particular programs mainly. So there is a gender power analysis that also has to be done, you know, around the workforce. And so I might handball to Kate to see if she's got some thoughts on that. But we've also wanted to, just before I do, is point out that we're also intrigued in our Australian context that this is also Indigenised. So we have a history of Indigenous people, our First Nations people, also trying to respond to this issue, which has been largely invisible, unpaid. Aboriginal-controlled community organisations have been very poorly supported, but there is a lot of invisible work happening in this space as well. So I might just handball Kate to see if you've got any comments about the gendered nature of this workforce.
Yeah. Well, there's a number of things there, and I think one of them, which we can't overlook, is that what First Nations people have consistently been telling us when it comes to domestic violence is that a gendered lens does not fit well for them, that in the sense of the traditional kind of, you know, male perpetrators are dealt with over here, and, you know, that what they consistently tell us, both in practice, in policy and in other realms, is that that's not a good way to work in First Nations context, because they see it as about the ongoing impacts of colonisation, et cetera, et cetera. So that's another whole, you know, discussion in itself, but I think we have to foreground that. And so in many ways the kind of history of domestic violence theorising and activism has, First Nations people would tell us, has really not spoken for them and has left them, has tried to speak for them, and in a way that hasn't been respectful or necessarily useful. So I guess let's just make sure we point that out. In terms of the gendered workforce, so this is work, domestic violence work, whether you work with men or whether you work with women or whether you work with children, it is gendered work, not only because it's gendered work, but also because the nature of the issue is so highly gendered in the sense of, you know, the power relationships, gendered, classed, raced, and everything else you can think of. So the focus has tended to be on the issue and not on the actual way the work is done, the way work is organised, etc. So there have been separate researchers who focus on domestic and family violence, those who focus on, you know, organisational setup and the nature of work, etc. But they haven't really come together, haven't really spoken to each other. And so I think that's what we're trying to do, is trying to kind of bring them together in terms of thinking about what does that tell us, how does that help us to think differently about the issues and the implications of them. So we know that all social work and any sort of care work is very gendered, and so this is of course no different, but it plays out differently in different types of DFV work. So work with men has different elements and different touch points than work with women, and that the broader politics around domestic and family violence plays out in the valuing of different work in different ways. But certainly that one of the things the National Plan did is speak, you know, very loudly about perpetrators should be held accountable, and that's a real mantra. And whilst in one way of thinking that's perfectly logical and makes sense, the problem with that is that, number one, it treats perpetrators as if they're, you know, they walk around with a hat on that says I'm a perpetrator. But number two, it's quite punitive, and it sort of opens the door to kind of quite, you know, you do a program and then you fix type of stuff. And so overlooks the really long-term and difficult complexity of that work. But also it's led to a very strong focus on perpetrators must be held accountable and they've got to get help, et cetera, et cetera. And there's been a lot of focus on that mantra, on that tough talk, if you like, but not much on who's actually going to do that. Where is it going to happen? Who's going to fund it? All that kind of stuff. So,
and what knowledge do we bring to that?
And how, who, what, you know.
Yeah.
And so, but we still hear that tough talk. But when you say, well, where are these men going? Where are they being referred? We have that, you know, on the whole, there's very little. There's a real mismatch between the rhetoric, which is the tough stuff, which is kind of fits with the broader law and order, you know, discourse around tough on crime and all that, right? So it says, you know, it does pitch perpetration of violence as more criminal than it is anything else. And I forgot what I was going to say. Yeah.
No, that's really useful. Thank you. As you're talking, one of the things I was thinking about is we've been kind of implicitly referencing Karabakis What's the Problem Representative analysis framework. And one of the ideas in that is she suggests an avenue to analyze policy is to look at, I think she calls it the concrete proposals, or in other words, like what's actually being done about it. And so if you've got a plan that has this complex analysis of domestic and family violence, but it doesn't have until the third or fourth iteration anybody actually working in this space, then you can ask the question, well, is that actually representing anything at all? Is it actually got a problem there that we're trying to solve? Or the other way of thinking about it is if we're just addressing perpetrators, right? And it's saying essentially that's the problem and we just need to intervene in very specific ways with specific
and
people.
Rescue women. Go in and rescue them.
That's right.
Our white hats and horses.
That's great. So that looking at what's actually being done in the workforce tells us about how people really think about the problem of domestic family violence. It's complex analysis, nice, but at the end of the day, we still intervene in the same ways or don't intervene or have this workforce, I think you said, is like volunteer or part-time and highly gendered. So that's how we think the problem's going to be solved, by having these people do this kind of work.
And because of that, we only see particular victims.
Great. Yeah. So we're going to see certain problems, certain victims, and respond in certain ways. Really useful. Thank you. You've been really generous, and we probably have just a couple of minutes left. But before you go, I wanted to ask you, what should, if I'm a, you know, a student or perhaps I'm a practitioner in this space already, what can I make of all of this? You know, what should I do? Where can I look for some more information? You know, what do we do with this critique that we're giving today?
I would think the very first thing is when you hear talk in the media, or whether it's in the media or in the popular public domain, or whether it's in your own workplace or whatever, is to think really carefully about what you're hearing. You know, just think about whatever you're hearing, you know, how is this issue being represented, who's being named and who isn't being named. So I think that's the beginning point, and that has no beginning or end, because that should be, you know, your new kind of the new hat that you wear as you go out into the world in terms of thinking really carefully and critically about what you hear.
I was gonna similarly say, you know, reading policy, I think it is important that we kind of ask, you know, what is the purpose, who was this for, who was going to benefit, and who was missing, and kind of recognize the limitations of policy. However, I also don't, you know, want to paralyze students with critique, you know, because sometimes that can, you know, when you're a new social worker, you know, if you're only in a space of critique, sometimes you don't even know what to do. So I want to encourage, you know, students to be political or to advocate. So when you know your policies, or you know its history, or you try and understand its purpose, use it for benefit. So again, so we're not passive in how we use policy. So I would encourage students to not be paralyzed by gaps or limitations of policy. Point them out and know them, but try and use them for benefit as well.
In both practice, because we know that, as we started with, policy is only what's actually...
Yes.
Policy in practice is only what's actually done.
Yes, true.
But also, you know, that, so it's around doing what you can and maintaining a critical lens on practice, but also recognising that everything is political, actually, and that you need to speak up sometimes and ask difficult questions, because that's the only way that social change happens.
Right. Thank you. Great takeaways. Thank you so much. All right. Well, before we run off, please tell us just a little bit about what you're working on at the moment and how people can find out some more about us. A shameless self-plug would be excellent.
Look, if we're going to go shameless self-plug, I reckon, Ben, if you haven't already, please alert your students to Swirls. You know, you'll see our wonderful researchers on the website. You'll see what we've been working on. Both Kate and I have Twitter accounts. Pretty easy to search us, I think. Swirls has a Twitter account. I'd love our students to join the Swirls Twitter account and watch this space, because Swirls is also about to relaunch and share some of our other research projects. So, you know, quickly, in terms of, you know, what's in our agenda, you know, Kate and I are now working on and working with the Fair Work Commission on domestic and family violence leave in the workplace. We are also working on understanding concepts of home in residential care. We're working with child protection around that intersection of domestic and family violence. What else are we doing, Kate? We're trying to write a book.
And relevant today, we have a very large project which is looking at
the domestic and family,
domestic and family violence workforce.
Mm.
So that's a large project that we're about to start that will actually allow us to really get our teeth into this kind of things we've been talking about.
I was going to say,
But
I also want to say, kind of finishing up, Ben, like this has been a really useful conversation, and I hope that students see that, you know, as social workers, you know, our kind of research policy practice arms don't sit in isolation, and, you know, and we're really committed to bringing that into the teaching space as well. So we kind of see those four pillars as being really, really good friends, and they need to be tight, close friends, not separate.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah, really important takeaway there as well. Well, I'll provide links to both Swirls and your Twitter account, if that's okay, on the show notes, so I'm sure people can find that. But thank you again so much. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
This episode was edited by Ryan Manhire, music by Anthem of Rain, sourced from the freemusicarchive.org. You can find me, Ben, on Twitter at LohmeyerBen. If you like the podcast, please like, share, comment, and do all the things.